what these tools allow us is that I don't need to be a data engineer anymore to actually model my own GPT. And the beauty of that is I can model my audience. I can model the business. I can create synthetic versions of my environment, of the company, of the consumer, of the employee, of my partners. I can create the whole organization virtually.
Today, we have the privilege of delving into the mind of Dominik Heinrich, co-founder and innovator of Creative AI Academy. With 2 decades of experience, Dominik has built, managed, and led highly diverse world-class design, AI, and innovation teams globally. As a distinguished faculty member at Pratt University, Dom brings his wealth of experience to the classroom, enlightening students on the intricacies of AI in digital design and design business. But his impact doesn't stop there. Dom is also a driving force behind the Creative AI Academy, a beacon of cutting-edge education and consulting services in the realm of generative artificial intelligence. Through this academy, he's pushing the boundaries of what is possible with AI. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the journey with Dom's fascinating world of design, AI, and innovation.
Dom, it's so great to have you on today. You started your career in marketing. You were a ski instructor at one point, and you've evolved your career through multiple creative avenues. And today, you're a thought leader on AI. Where you are the co-founder of the Creative AI Academy. You're a public speaker on AI. Let's back us up a little bit and tell us how you went from your early career and how those experiences evolved into where you are today as an AI expert.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Simon. I'm super excited to be on the Play & Co. Podcast and Play & Co. Conversations, right? Is the right pronunciation of it or the right name? As you can hear on my accent, grew up in Germany, in the south of Germany, which is very particular, in Munich, Bavaria. Most people know it about the FC Bayern, the soccer club, but I think it is also known for its beautiful nature and of bringing out people like me. I'm probably not the only one who has made it out to the world. I think the mountains push you out in the world as beautiful as they are. I started in finance. A lot of people don't believe that, but my parents were very confident that finance is the future of the center of the universe. And as we know today, about 25 years later, that might not be true. And I was always very creative, and I had a fable for creativity and digital early on, and got into this world of digital marketing, as you mentioned, Simon, in the beginning. And I had 10 years my own agency, and I failed massively. And it's good, because otherwise we wouldn't probably talk. I sold it, had an exit with no success, means I made no money. The company went insolvent a few years later, and I learned a lot. And that brought me to the day where I'm today. I got way more into design, way more into innovation, blurring the lines between digital and physical world. Worked for McCann World Group, in particular for MRM, and built up their global innovation and design practice for the last 10 years successfully. Were named Best Workplace for Innovators, thanks to Lab 13, my team, which I'm really proud of, still proud. They are still there, some of them. And we had a lot of success. And since you asked, AI was always a part of our work. Early on, I would say in 2014, 2013, we used machine learning capabilities, analytic capabilities, data, in creating experiences. And we never used AI or technology as something that's at the forefront. We always wanted to make it beautiful and useful, but most importantly, invisible. And that was the success of the projects. We have patents for them. And I was fortunate that I had a small role in the Wired documentary, Being Human in an AI World. And then 2022, I decided to venture off and try something new. That brings me to what I'm doing today, Creative AI Academy. Really proud of what the team is doing. I have the consulting role in the piece. Tony Jones, my co-founding partner, runs the training for organizations. So we upskill organizations and talents on AI. And then we have a coach, an executive coach, Stala Sireno. She runs basically the cultural changes that are influenced by AI.
Awesome. The exit, I'm glad you hit on that, your first experience and a lot of failures, because I think it's something we gloss over a lot and people gloss over a lot from time to time. When they talk about exits, they're like, oh yeah, I exited. But I'm glad you just kind of owned it, put it out there and said, a lot of failures and I exited, no success, no money. How do you think that affected you back then, and did it course correct you? Was it something that was a lesson that put you on to this track that led you to Lab 13, or was there more soul searching, or was it just one of those organic kind of forks in the road?
That's a great question, Brendan. I think I learned a lot. I have actually, I gave a talk a few years back about the magic of failing, and I think it's fundamental to accept failure as a part of the process. And we have heard that in the innovation and design for many, many years. I think my big learning out of what happened there was, what are my strengths and what are my weaknesses? And which of the weaknesses are fundamentally important in my career to progress and I need to overcome and fix? And what are the things I need to accept that I'm not good at? And ask for help. One of the things we are not good at, all of us, I guess. And so that is my biggest learning out of that. And it, I think what it taught me is that nothing is for certain, nothing is forever. And dreaming about things is helpful from a creative perspective, but in a leadership role, which I had at that time, it was really hurtful, right? And I ignored the warning signals. I ignored the obvious, right? That it was not set up for success. It was set up for failure. And ego is something that I definitely lost in that process, which some people will not agree. But I'm actually, ego and excitement can be very easily be confused. And I'm often very excited about things and speak it out loud, which might be a little bit misleading, but excitement and ego are things that are in balance. And I think at that time I didn't know the balance of that and ignored the warning signals, to repeat myself. But that was the bigger thing. Still making mistakes, same ones.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear that because, when you were telling me that, I'm like, man, this guy's got it figured out. And I'm sure that people who take the time to listen to this and heed your advice, I kind of, Karen and I feel sometimes like we've done the same thing. We read all the textbooks, we knew all the rules, but we kind of had to be burnt by the cigarette lighter all the time.
Yeah, that's the only way you tend to learn and trying to.
That's the only way it's imprinted into you, who you are, your psyche and your character, is by making the mistakes and feeling the pain. I'm less adept at post-mortems and saying, okay, this is what I want to do in the future. I'm a little bit more like a tumbleweed. so we kind of go in the way that the wind is blowing, but not necessarily the most effective way, but we're getting better. We're getting better. Okay.
Yeah. And I just wanted to add to what you said. There's a famous author, Gay Hendricks, which you probably have heard from. And I admired him. And I met him last November, actually, in person, which was really eye-opening. And what you just said is, we're getting burned again. And I think the most important part is commitment. And I think when we come to innovation, it means a lot of commitment, and it leads to recommit, right? When we make mistakes and learn from them, and we will make them again. So recommit again. And that makes us better over time. And that will hopefully lead us to a better self and a more happier self. I think some of the failures are maybe not as big or problematic than we think they are. And personally, we are probably always more judgmental on ourselves than anybody else's from the outside.
And I can imagine this strong sense of self-awareness has led to a sense of self-belief, which, you know, I'm certain you were looking at AI before everybody else was in 2022, 2023. So how did this trajectory like move you in that intensive AI focus, which is the main focus of your career right now?
A great question. Let me think of it for a second, because it is so long for me, a natural part. And
yeah, we want you to answer this one right.
there's no magic bullet to this one, I can tell you this. And it was honestly in 2017 and 18, I gave a workshop around artificial intelligence because we built this project for the United States Postal Service, which was basically using voice recognition to turn your physical stamp into, we called it voice stamp, but it was basically a digital stamp at that time. You didn't need any other physical stamp on a mail, on a package anymore. You could just use your voice to activate that and then send out a package, and it was using the address as an identification, and they spray a barcode anyway. So it uses the address, checks for postage. There's no postage on it. Instead of rejecting it, check digital and send it out. Just explaining where this was coming from. And then that project led actually, we have patents for that project together with the Postal Service. That project led actually to these conversations with others where they invited me to workshops and talk about AI. General Motors was one of them. We worked on an AI strategy together with Diana Kurler and Kirsten Richardson. And so the interesting part was, for me, I never saw it as a machine or something obscure. I saw it as a augmentation of life, augmentation of processes. And I think that's when it came in, when it came really popular in 2022, I wasn't surprised by it. It's actually funny. I remember the exact date. I think it was September 29th or 30s. I was sitting together with James Everingham. He's the VP technology at Meta for emerging technologies and AI. And James and I were sitting, and James shared with me DALL-E because he had access to it and told me about it. And that surprised me in that moment. And I was like, wow, this is cool. But then when ChatGPT launched, I wasn't surprised because we worked on the Microsoft project using GPT-1 or building up GPT-1 at that time with Coca-Cola. And it was so fascinating because it wasn't mind-blowing to me, but a lot of people reached out who knew about it and said, can you talk about it? And so I started late 2022 with talks and gave a workshop again, repeating basically what I've done in 2017. And I realized quickly, this is different this time. Suddenly, the generative AI technology is actually giving us the ability to democratize our relationship with machines in a way we haven't seen before. And I think that was, for me, the starting point. That was the point when we founded the Creative AI Academy. And when we have a certificate course, AI Design at Pratt in New York. And that's when all these conversations started. And for me, it was not a 2021 metaverse, which I never, the way it was described, I never believed in.
Yeah.
It was more a natural progression over the time.
We'd like to take a moment to remind you that Play & Conversations is brought to you by Play & Co. If you want to explore more about design opportunities, discover new insights, or connect with Play & Co. for a design project, be sure to visit playandco.com.
You didn't buy any virtual real estate in the metaverse?
Nope.
No.
I asked some of my ex-colleagues. I think they were not pleased about my opinion in meetings.
yeah, that's...
Let's leave it there.
Okay. Well, can we circle back to the USPO for a second? Because I'm quite shocked that they, if anyone has ever been into a US Postal Service office, it's encouraging to hear that they do spend a bit of money on and time and effort on research and improving services. So it actually works very well, I guess, the USPO, in spite of some often hardened, disgruntled service people at the front desk. But when you were explaining that process to me, I understand now how this was a very organic extension of where you'd come from. And what I heard was that it was an enabler of systems design, that you were presented with a problem or a challenge, and then the most logical choice was implementing AI for the voice stamp. Voice recognition stamp. So that to me was kind of like a little light bulb, systems design.
I wish I could agree and say it was a very systematic approach. The truth, Brandon, is the typical approach of clients, and this is no different with this client, was they come to you and they have a question about a technology they think is really popular.
Right.
AI, voice, metaverse, NFT, you name it. We will see more. Spatial will be the next big thing. And we approached it from a perspective of, like you said, human-centered design. What could it be? How could it work? And we built a device that retrofits on the smart blue, on the blue boxes, the postal boxes, which you see all over the US. Because that's their real estate. They can do with it whatever they want. And we saw that as an opportunity to put a Amazon Alexa kind of device on top of it. When we did that, one of the things that came out quickly in the experience was that they don't give you postage. They weigh the mail, they let you validate it, but there was no real ease, right? And there was no real problem solved. And then that was actually where we actually dig deeper and understood, okay, what's the ecosystem look like? What are the possibilities? And I thought, oh, okay, we are on voice. Can't we use voice as a recognition because it's unique? Everybody of us has a unique voice. It's identifiable. And we looked at the ecosystem of how the Postal Service is actually processing mail through the system and through their system. And as I described earlier, they basically check for the address, the destination address, and for postage, spray a barcode, and that barcode is, until that point of delivery, the unifier or the identification code. And so that was basically a really easy understanding of how this could be transformed. They haven't implemented it to date, as far as I understand. But at that time, we launched it at CES 2017, and it was a huge project. Obviously, we also got a lot of kickback from the people who collecting stamps and were kind of frightened that they can't collect stamps anymore. So, which is interesting, right? How the complexity of our world looks today. You can't see it just from one angle. It's like, and I think that's where AI comes into play on where we are today, in the, seeing that whole spectrum of there's behaviors, not just from my target audience, but from the machine itself, from the environment, from other people who are involved in the system, to the technology that is able to help me to actually activate this, to the context I'm creating, which can be the culture, the society. Mm. So we actually talk a lot about behavior, technology, and context as an involvement of the old human technology business model. And because you need to see it more holistically. And I think AI has an ability to help you in that process.
What's your take on the current state of AI? Because you mentioned Pratt, so you are a lecturer on AI and design. We're seeing from OpenAI, a new video rendering capability. We've got AI ethics popping up almost on a weekly basis. What's your current perspective on AI today and the direction you think it's going in?
If I would know the answer to which direction it goes, I would probably be very rich and put my bets on that. I think nobody really knows. I think there's some smart answers to that from that, as I said earlier, human language is the new user interface. Just thinking about the future, right? I think from a today's standpoint, I think it augments our life in many ways. I think there's a big misconception of automation, efficiency, speed. I hear a lot of people talking about this, and I think I personally see it differently. It's also what we teach the students. And if you spend a little bit of time with it, you quickly realize you're not necessarily faster. You can get significantly better. That's interesting. There's certain ways that make your life maybe easier, like Microsoft Copilot builds a PowerPoint for you. If you have ever used that, you know this is okay. Right, but it's not good. It will get good. That's probably a very easy prediction. So what do we do with this time? Do we do more PowerPoints or do we spend more time on thinking? Right, and that's an interesting observation I'm having. If I look into the future and if I would have this, I said this a couple of times in other podcasts as well, is I have this hopeless romantic view, and I'm hoping, actually I'm not hopeless, but I have this view that it makes us better humans and it actually leads us to be more human again.
Yeah.
We're so dominated by technology today. Mm. We are so dominated by what it does to our life. I think we can't even grasp the complexity of it anymore.
Yeah.
And the applications it will have. So I think it will make us better communicators, and it will probably to less technology in front of our face and more seamlessly integrated in our life. The metaverse will have its revival, that's for sure, in a different way than people think, probably. And I think that's my perspective on it. And Simon, you mentioned ethics, you mentioned responsible use, and I totally agree. I think is a very important topic. In we coming up to an election this year in the US, I think we will see a lot of things we don't want to see. But the fundamental answer, or the thing I would like everybody to think about, is AI the enemy, or is it the human who uses AI? And that brings us to something to really think about, I think.
Yeah, deep. I want to touch on something that you said a little bit further back, and I hope I'm not rewinding too much the conversation, but you mentioned faster, and that's, you're not sure whether or not this affords us the ability to go faster. Some conversations we've had on the past earlier on, Simon, when we were looking into like Stable Diffusion, and some of the Jason, our senior designer, was looking at how it can augment his creative process. One of the topics that came up that you hit on was about speed, and that we at a certain point we said is faster better, and faster is something that the collective conscious often jumps on and says, well, I can do more, but doesn't necessarily think about what that means in terms of value. So with Jason, we were like, well, knowing you as an obsessive creative, does this help you to do your work faster and free up time at the end of the day? Or does it just send you into this spiral of creative kind of
more is more
creative tornado, which confuses people even more. So I thought that was a fascinating point.
What was his answer? What did he say?
We didn't have an answer at that point. That's the point. We're kind of conflicted. And I think that's, Karen was going to jump in too. So maybe she can help clarify.
No, I was thinking it was coming back to like one of the things that I strongly believe. It's always that it comes to the person's inception, like your idea, your creative process, which you brought up with a human thought, is the first and fundamental approach before you jump into something. And it doesn't matter, you know how you were talking about the PowerPoint, making more PowerPoints. You have something in your mind that you visually see or you want to create, and it doesn't matter how much you try, it's never going to be what you think it's going to be. Like, you might get close, but it's like, no, it's not exactly what I want. So I always think it's like, as much as it supports us making like our lives easier, it still doesn't bring that fundamental initial thought or idea that the human creates. That's what I believe. I believe that maybe AI can do it, but it's never the way that you will initially incept it.
Yeah, yeah, there are experience drivers and then there are experience enablers, and we see it as an enabler. Technology is more of an enabler than a driver. And so to your point before about the client coming to you and saying, hey, what about NFTs? What about AI? What about this? That's the enabler of an experience driver or a problem that we're trying to solve. And I like the way that you guys went back and said, well, what's the problem that we're trying to solve? And does this technology make sense, or is there a better way to do it?
Yeah. And I agree with both of you, Karen and Brandon. And I think what it enables us to do is it gives us knowledge we don't have, or it gives us answers to a creative idea we don't have. I had a project for a soap company. They said, oh, so many people buying now the very expensive dispenser soaps from Aesop and everything else. We are big in the market of refilling, but the competition is getting bigger now because everybody goes into buying these expensive ones and then buy refill. How can we leap the competition, and what can we do in that space? And one of the things we looked at was, can we make the refill process more seamless and easier? If you prompt that to an ChatGPT as an example, you get all sorts of answers. If you use Llama from Meta, you get all sorts of answers, similar, different. If I don't think about it, if I don't push the boundaries, it will never give me an answer that is groundbreaking. It had a lot of good ideas. The moment it clicked for me personally was, I'm excited about space. And I think to Simon's question, what the future will look like, I think we will talk in 5-10 years more about the space economy. It's going to be an exciting one. But at that time, I was like, how would an astronaut actually refill soap in zero gravity? And how would this work? And that's where ChatGPT gives you an answer. But it's based on to Karen's point, on my thinking, on my creativity or ingenuity or out of the box thinking at that moment, or being in the shower. We all know that, right? But now, suddenly we get answers to these questions, and suddenly we get validation, because you can actually use it and say, okay, how would this work on Earth? What do I need to do? How do I apply this? How do I make this a product? I think that ability, aside from creating images, videos, I think we are at least five, Tony and I, my partner in creative AI, we have a big debate about this. I think this is 10 years away. Tony thinks it's 3 years away. So we will be probably somewhere in the middle.
I think it's here now. Didn't you see Sora last week?
Yeah, but Sora is a stunt at the moment. It's
right.
It's going to be good, but look at the length of the videos.
Yeah.
Look at the quality of the videos, and just anticipate that it took them hours over hours over hours to get to the point where they are and what they're sharing with us. Mm-hmm. We will get there, but look at Midjourney. Some of these images are not usable. Look at DALL-E. It is still at least 5 years away, if you ask me personally.
So back to Creative AI Academy. if any listeners want to go to the website, it's creative-ai.academy. And on the website, you have a description. You say, we are AI evangelists, AI assisted design instructors, patented inventors, thinkers, award winners, co-creators of the best workplace for innovators, according to Fast Company, and are featured in Wired's documentary, Being Human in an AI World. So In terms of the existence of the Creative AI Academy, you have various AI training and consulting, whether it's for a C-suite or custom prompt designs for professionals, AI workflows and use case design. Can you talk more about this Creative AI Academy and the kind of work you're doing there, and maybe just what sort of projects you're noticing in the landscape? Like, is it prompt engineering? Is it specific like production work where you do AI, or what's the big goal of Creative AI Academy?
I mean, I think I need to hire you more often to speak on our behalf. I would not be able to articulate that so nicely.
I'll send you his rate sheet after the podcast.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that was really, really kind. So we have a couple of things. So what we learned early on very quickly is, and where we focused on, we said we need to do the workshops hands-on. We keep the group small. We don't make a video platform. The space is evolving and everybody's use case is so different. And as Karen said so nicely, it's about thinking and enhancing our capabilities as humans. And I think it's really important to be in an environment where you can teach that. And so we teach basically prompt design. We don't call it engineering. I think it's misleading. It's a design approach to a prompt design approach to our capabilities. If you're a good copywriter, you need a prompt design approach. It is if you're a good designer, if you're a good innovator, etc. And we have legal people, we have project managers, we have all sorts of depth and breadth of people joining us. Even people from Google come to us and thinking it's helpful for them. And so the interesting part is we do it very hands-on. We look at usually at workflows and use cases and define what are the barriers, what are the desired outcomes, what are the barriers, and how can AI help? And then we look at the spectrum of AI tools that can help in the certain instances. And based on that, we basically build a system, an ecosystem for them in their workflow and teach them how to prompt, how to go from one tool to another tool and combine things. How do I combine things? And we teach them how to think critically about the outcomes, how to push the boundaries. And what people, I think, struggle with at the moment is they misunderstand it as a Google. I go in, I ask a question, I get an answer, but the system doesn't work that way. It is not intelligent. It's not sitting around and wondering, what will Simon and Karen ask me next, right? It is not doing that. It is very passive, and it is a big liar sometimes. It's very confident. But we teach people to understand that and understand that the length and the input of your prompt has an influence on the output, because it's just using your words to predict the answer, which, by the way, could be a huge discussion around copyrights, because if it's just predicting the output based on my input, then it's at least a co-invention of an idea at the end. Mm-hmm. Different topic. And so we do this a lot. What we learned over time is leadership is a big part of it. So we created a leadership framework together with Stala, which we call Best in AI. Best stands for balanced, empowered, seamless, and trusted. Balanced, autonomous, or automated versus augmented. Empowered, meaning giving people the power to use it, be proud of it. I used it. I created this idea with AI. People are shy about this. There's a Salesforce study saying 64% of people using AI and do not tell anybody. So they are afraid of telling that. I think that needs to change, which is then the seamless part, right? This is a part of our workflow. How do I integrate this in my workflow? And trusted means about transparency, responsible use, ethics, data, etc. And we teach that leaders, because we feel like they need to have the understanding how they manage their teams. If somebody is not good in delegating humans, they will not be good in using AI, because it's a lot of delegation. You need to brief properly. So that's where my hope for the future of humans comes. It's like, if we get better in briefing machines, maybe we get better in briefing and communicating with humans. So we discussed that a lot. And over that process, to answer your question, Simon, is we learned that just doing a training and then letting it go isn't really working. We actually learned that it's a culture that needs to be built. It is. It requires a different mindset, a transformation of the organizational processes and workflows. And you need to create a habit. So we have a habit training, which we then edit. And we do it through education as a service. It's a subscription. It's not marketing. It has really purpose. The idea is constant training, constant habit creation, that it becomes a part of your workflow. Mm. Otherwise, it will not be successful. And that is actually where we also talk a lot about the human AI relationship, and how would AI become a seamless part in our relationship and talking to each other at the moment without distracting us, which is a big topic as well.
I have a question about the Creative AI Academy, and it's not really about the work that you do, but it's more about how it came to be and how you create awareness and how you attract these customers and clients, because you definitely are AI entrepreneurs, right? And we've been using this analogy on some of our projects recently. You're kind of building the airplane while it's taking off. So you're discovering formulas and observations and frameworks, creating frameworks on the fly. How is that manifest? How did Google find you guys? Is it, you know, 80% the three of you, the leadership's network? Does your role at Pratt kind of help serve that, the relationship with the university? I think it'd be interesting for the audience to hear a little bit about that too.
I want to emphasize too that, you know, like if you were to go to a different the traditional design agency, you know, that's something that's been like in legacy and you sort of know what you're going to get. But to further double down on Brendan's, Karen, like this is a whole new service offering period that the potential client doesn't even know what to ask for. So I just want to emphasize that point as too, but sorry, Dom.
No, this is good, Brendan, because my answer to Simon, my answer to Brendan would have been very quick, which is we are very fortunate that people reach out to us. Never experienced that in my life. We do not do any advertisement. We spend very little on Google AdWords and very little on LinkedIn, almost nothing. And people naturally come to us. And I think Pratt is definitely helping us. Mm. Our reputation maybe helps because we're known for things. This helps. So thank you for inviting me. These things definitely help us. The rest is really people who know us, who reach out, who liked working with us before, who come to us and say, hey, can we have a chat about this? We get also people reaching out organically. So that's really the marketing myth about this is very simple. There is no marketing. Strange for people like us to say that. Tony would slightly disagree. He would like to do more.
Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't said Tony's got a virtual AI assistant that helps us to optimize our audience and build our sales funnel.
Now we built a GPT for some of the things, but there's no magic bullet. I mean, we do a lot of sharing on LinkedIn and Instagram. Yeah. Obviously, we do that. But I think that the speaking engagements, the panels, the podcasts that help the most.
Totally.
But to Simon's point, I think what's so interesting is I think we talk slightly different about it. So when we talk about innovation and design, we talk about a horizon 4 instead of the 3 horizons. We think you need to think about the 4th horizon, which is challenging for people. We talk a lot about computational design. So how is actually data and algorithms help us simulate solutions? We have this framework, which we created for TLGG Consulting, a firm I consult with, where we said that the new framework, the new design thinking framework is PRIME. So train a model with data, simulate solutions and iterate. And it's probably going back and forth all the time. So I think that changes fundamentally. And then to Simon's questions also, we look at the third and fourth order, the second and third order effect on solutions, right? Where it's like, if I implement AI here, what does this mean in the system for, in the third order effect to society, to the business, to the environment, to all these elements? And I think the way we speak about these things, also publicly, is making a difference why people reach out to us and why people also ask us about consulting elements. We usually do an initial consulting and then hand it over to a TLGG or others.
Can I just, when you were speaking, as soon as you started answering that, I feel like Creative AI Academy feels like a thought leadership tank. And I think that what we all are aware of is that there's kind of this, there's a lot of snake oil sellers out there too. Like there's like, they throw in AI as, you know, everything but this kitchen sink kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. And I think you have the reputation, you have the credibility, you have speaking events. I think it's in the vernacular that you're setting up, the way, the way that you're framing your point of view around the challenges, and even things like saying we don't believe it's engineering, we call it prompt design. I think those to me are big things. And so that builds kind of an authenticity and trust that is kind of implicit in your brand message, I would say. So that's what I heard.
Yeah. I think we see a lot of people claiming the topic who have been Metaverse experts last year and NFT experts the year before and voice experts and data experts and whatever.
Pinball and experts think, the year before that.
Yeah. And I feel what's so interesting is people like to create awareness about fear and about what a monster AI is and all the negativity and... That's not wrong, right? It's like, we need to talk about this, and I think we need this balance. I personally be a little bit, not reluctant, but I want to see the positive of it. I want to see, and if you don't want to follow me or if you don't want to trust me, that's on you. That's not my business. It's not my problem. But I want to be authentic about it. And I see it very positive, and I see the possibilities everywhere. And of course, I see also the negativity, but that's the beauty of technology. To use the example of how Apple talks about AI, everybody thinks they're behind. They're not behind. Mm. They just have a different language about it. It's anything in our iPhones is AI, right?
Yeah.
And depth effect, AI. And it's like how we use the camera. Is AI. Do they talk about it? No. Why? It's no reason. What is the human implication to it and what's the benefit? That's what they talk about. What's the value I'm getting? So I do not agree with that statement. And I think that's maybe where people feel that it is better to raise their voice and be negative about something. I think we have enough negativity in the world already. Don't want to make AI negative too.
Agreed. And Dom, you gave a keynote here in New York not that long ago as a part of a Pratt keynote series about reimagining design work specifically in the age of AI. I know we've touched on this a couple of times already in this conversation, but this being a very design leading audience, how do you think specifically in the design world, is AI revolutionizing the design space? And where do you think that creativity and human relationship is moving specifically for practicing designers, whether it's graphic design, industrial design, UX design, design leadership? What does that look like to you through that lens? Mm.
I think Karen said it beautifully on one part, just picking on this one more time, because I think is in enhancing us, right? It helps our thinking in many ways. From a design standpoint, from a process standpoint, I think I talked about prime, simulate, iterate as a method, mm-hmm. which we apply. Third order thinking as a thinking method is great. It maybe changes the design thinking in total. I have a slide where I talk about the difference between classic design and design thinking, and that we most likely move into something that I call at the moment infinite design, right? Because it gives us infinite possibilities. I can simulate everything. And I think the simulate part is the one part I would like to dive in for a second. What these tools allow us is that I don't need to be a data engineer anymore to actually model my own GPT. And the beauty of that is I can model my audience. I can model the business. I can create synthetic versions of my environment, of the company, of the consumer, of the employee, of my partners. I can create the whole organization virtually, basically, and then loop them in conversations with ideations. And if I do this, there's a lot of data that needs to go in. There's a lot of thinking that needs to go in. But we use, for example, a method which we created for synthetic personas, where we basically give in the GPT builder the ability to say, you're this persona. If you get a question from me, if I ask you a question, give me the answer and wait until I give you the next answer, but build on the question before and my answer. And you can do this vice versa, right? Ask me a question and build on my answers. And so suddenly you create a loop in a chat window, which I think is really, really interesting and really powerful. And we teach in Pratt a lot about, especially in the module about AI augmented innovation processes, around that topic, right? How can infinite design become a part? How can I simulate things? Because simulate means I probably have the ability to create a solution that really goes to market and will be successful because I can pre-simulate everything. Computational design and architecture is, since many decades actually, basic, right? They use it in everything because our brain doesn't work that way. We think linear, but
totally.
This gives us the ability to think way beyond systematic, and it has an infinite thinking suddenly.
Yeah.
And that's so powerful. And I think we still don't grasp it. And we try to teach it at least in a way that people can apply it. And so the synthetic part is, I think, something what is really powerful and shouldn't be underestimated.
Oh, so much to unpack there. I think to your point on the computational design being decades in the making, we've built industries around teaching people to learn the tools. And I think what you're hinting at is that the ability to teach the tools to learn the human, maybe, or make it far easier to flip that script a little bit. And I kind of got tingles when you started talking about I can simulate the full models. So I can simulate a business model. I can simulate an audience model. I can simulate a service model. And to me, that gets really exciting because so much of what creators and designers do is it is slow and tedious kind of desktop research, framing, discussing, building our perspective, but building out those simulations in the best way that we can. And if that can be augmented and amplified, I see huge value there for beyond design thinking into what you're calling infinite design. So I've never heard anyone talk about the benefits of AI from a designer or a creator's perspective to that level. You see the noise on LinkedIn of spinning a car or a shoe on and then plugging in some prompts and then seeing this carpet bomb of 30 different alternatives spitting out the back end. And that has its place, but you're thinking very much more on a business impact kind of level, systemic level. Yeah. So it's
I think
super cool.
I think the other, all the other elements have a big place to in this as well, right? We very early on decided at Pratt, together with the Pratt faculty, with the Pratt leadership, that we want to focus on, yes, we want to teach them how to use prompt design in image generation, video generation, chatting, but also I think education will change fundamentally. We also train the faculty at Georgetown University, which is interesting, or the faculty at University of Luzern. And so the interesting part is, I think knowledge isn't that needs to be shared. It needs to be shared, but it needs to be understood as well. And critical thinking and a way of thinking and a way of applying it is important. And I think when I look at AI from a design perspective, it gives us actually the ability to overcome biases. And we know this as creative people, right? All of us, all the four of us sitting here, how often do we overthink or think the idea is not good? Or worse, we think we know what the consumer will do with it because we anticipate that, right? And I'm not saying the machine can suddenly do all that for us, but I think there is a possibility that certain things can be simulated. We used, if I may share that, in class, one example that was the collaboration between British Airways and Burberry, which you probably saw these amazing images about a year ago.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, if we have these images, let's model a persona. We used the persona in the class, so some of the students, and by the way, they're professional education, they're in professional education, so they have, some of them is working at Dell in marketing, and some is working at Amazon Prime Video. And so we have really amazing people there, diverse people, also a diverse group of people. And so we modeled one persona and said, okay, would you, if this is the blanket, would you steal the blanket? Would you pay for it? So we simulated the business model, and the answers were absolutely mind-blowing. And the best part, we had the human in the room, and she said, that would be exactly my answer. I would never steal something. I was like, if I like it and if the material is great, I would
I'm taking anything would, that's not bolted down.
Right, right. No, Australian, Brenton. I'm not surprised about that, Brenton.
You can tell by my beard stubble.
Dom, you... You've touched on this theme a little bit in this conversation, and you've talked about it before. But you know, where there's a lot of fear around AI and where it's going, you believe that there's more of a opportunity for sort of a symbiotic relationship between machine and human, but more specifically, it can reshape our culture and redefine what it means to be human. So what does that mean? And what is, in your opinion, the optimistic new horizon that we're moving towards with a lot of this stuff that you've been talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would like to use one example, which is close. That's the humane AI pin that's coming to the market, I think, end of March, beginning of April. And what I like about it is it is just hanging there like in the old days in Star Trek. You press the button, but
yeah,
you don't have a device in front of you anymore. Maybe we can discuss from a design perspective. We'd be curious how you feel about it, but okay, projecting something in my hand sounds weird, but watch some of the videos. It's quite fascinating. I ask a question and it answers, but the moment I put my hand in front of it, it projects the answer and stops talking out loud, right? So this is solving for the environmental part. But imagine I speak a different language than you do, and I want to communicate with you because I'm in a Japanese restaurant. I suddenly can do it. I speak my language, it translates it for me, you translate it back. Or I unfortunately only have a toy car in front of me, but I hold something in front of me. I hold something in front of me, and it actually recognizes if I can eat it or not, because I have dietary restrictions or I have any diseases. Yeah. And so
huge.
This is for me the level I think we're going towards. And this is a first attempt, and we will have then the so-called experts probably taking it apart and thinking this is not the truth, and that's okay. I think this is the first step towards the future, and it's the bigger first step than what we've seen with the Apple Vision Pro.
Wow.
I'm not saying the Apple Vision Pro is not visionary, and I'm not saying that it is not in some capacity shaping our future. It is. But I think closer to our life, and that where we get the human-machine relationship in a different setting, is the humane AI pin. That's my perspective on it. And that's present and future at the same time.
If you want to continue the conversation, share your thoughts, or suggest topics for future episodes, be sure to connect with us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and LinkedIn at PlayNCo, or visit playnco.com.
We hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and until next time, keep playing, keep designing, and keep pushing the boundaries of what's next. This is Play In Conversations, signing off.